The following is Matthew Milan's talk, designed for the network from the 2014 Information Architecture Summit.
The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. Stay tuned after the podcast for more information about All You Can Learn.
So let's ask, what's the point of software? It's simple. Software gives us superpowers. Software augments us with incredible agency and capability. It can be a suit of armor, mega intelligence, super strength, anything that makes us both more human and less human. Software, interestingly, is both interface and agency. With great power and great agency comes great responsibility, and I want you to keep that in mind as I start to unpack this talk. So the talk today is designed for the network, and this talk actually started over a year ago as a way for us at Normative to better understand and explore and articulate what it meant for us to be a design firm in the 21st century. An advisor of ours, a gentleman named Michael Dila, who's been here a few times, challenged us and told us that we needed to have our Martin Luther moment. And this was the start of a conversation we've been having internally and increasingly externally with our clients for the last year. We call this conversation Design for the Network. It's a conversation, and it's not finished, but it's starting to have enough form that we feel comfortable talking about it with our peers. Essentially, Design for the Network, or DFTN, is the shorthand we're using for our emerging thesis of design, the idea that I'm going to talk about today, which is what it means for us to be software designers in the early days of the 21st century. Specifically, I want to start by talking with you all about networks, software, and systems, and what these things mean to us as designers. We're at a very important time, both as a society and as designers, and we should be excited, but also very thoughtful and respectful of the responsibility that we hold in our hands. The story of the network is really the story of society. It's the story of civilization. I want to start with a network we're all familiar with, the railroad. Not the only time it's actually been referenced today. Thank you, Andrew. This is a railroad map from 1910. It's a comprehensive network that provides coverage for much of the physical area of the United States. The network and the trains that operated on it provided an infrastructure for moving physical things from place to place. Stealing from some Canadian guy whose name I can't recall, this thing was really good at collapsing time and space. We all understand how the rail network changed the nature of business, bringing the hierarchical structure of the corporation to life. We've all heard that story. What gets lost is the software that enabled this to happen. Without the software of the train schedule, the new culture of the organization doesn't emerge. The software that kept the trains on time and kept them from crashing was what made the network of the railroad really valuable. Without the schedule, it's just a bunch of metal strips lying on the ground. The point that I'm making here is that software is what matters, and not necessarily software as code. I'm talking about software as feedback-driven rule sets, as self-regulating systems, as programs which can be designed. Networks become magical when you add software to them. There's a great word for magical networks, and it's systems. Whether it's physically connected like a railroad or connected in a more nuanced or biological way like an ecosystem, the connectedness of the network is brought to life with software. The feedback and feed-forward capabilities of software are really what make the magic happen. Whether it's centrally controlled like a train schedule or distributed like the flora and fauna in this marsh ecosystem, the marsh doesn't have a human hand at the tiller, but it's a fully functioning system, full of feedback loops, all seeking sweet, sweet equilibrium. So I'm a partner at a company called Normative in Toronto, and we design software. So what we call what we do software design. We love our work, complex software, simple software, it doesn't really matter. We don't discriminate. If it's software and it's connected to the internet, we're in a very happy place. One of my partners at Normative, a gentleman named Matt Nishalapidus, who's an interaction designer, but don't hold that against him, he loves talking about roads and the evolution of the road network. He makes some really great points about the Roman road system and how the Roman road system led to things like standardization so that carriages could work across the system. This is packet transfer, basically, but with extra horses. What's interesting here is that networks love standards. It's one of the things that allow us to build creative kinds of software capability on top of network infrastructure. The Roman Empire was literally a network. It was built on a network. a network of roads. The roads were standards-driven, they were extensive, they were consistent. They were the platform on which the Romans projected their strength and capability through the invention of logistics and supply chains. Basically, that's the software that they ran on their network. That's what allowed them to do what they did. One of the things that's fascinating is that sometimes we can become the software in a network. 20th century road network had all kinds of software in it, but for the longest time, the only software you'd find in the car itself was the software we had in our heads. This software was influenced by other software like motoring laws, traffic signal infrastructure, and road signs, but we'd also interact with that software ecosystem, bumping up against it with our own software, doing things like trying to not crash, going from place to place. Essentially, our software and the software around us created behavior like driving, which eventually resulted in millions of people driving all over the place. When you have things like behavior at scale, you get the emergence of culture, and there's no question that the car, and more importantly, the idea of driving cars, led to an incredible amount of cultural change over the last 100 years. One of the amazing things about culture is that it has the power to shape environments, and in many cases, you get unintended consequences at the environmental level. The idea of driving led to the development of new urban forms, including the suburb. Without really thinking about it, we ended up with an environment where driving, a behavior we used to control, became something we were required to do in order to get around. We got so focused on designing things like cars and suburbs that we forgot to keep working on the software with some arguably undesirable environmental consequences. So one of the things I believe we need to do is start to think differently about networks and what they represent to us. Networks as platforms, platforms that give us standards, which allow us to create and change capability, behavior, culture, and environments. I think this means we also need to think differently about what software is and how it changes behavior and creates culture. I'm a Canadian, and I've spent a significant amount of time in the US, and it's interesting for me that our constitutions, our software for rights management, doesn't have to be exactly the same to play a part in producing similar effects. There's other software at play, of course, that makes these two countries different, but sometimes the code doesn't have to be the same to get similar outcomes. You just have to think about how the software you create interacts with other software and gives agency to actors in a system. I'm digressing here a bit, but the founders who programmed the operating systems for these two great countries really understood what they were doing. They were doing more than just designing the experience of being Canadian or American. What they were doing was creating transgenerational abilities for a nation to survive and be successful on its own terms. I think this is pretty powerful software. And finally, I want us to start thinking differently about systems, specifically how we learn more about their nature without ever understanding their true nature, because that's essentially impossible. Working with systems isn't something where you can just prescribe an action and expect an outcome. The more complex the system, the less likely we are to ever understand it. We need to become comfortable as designers with learning more and more about the nature of a system, while at the same time never ever getting to a point where we truly understand or have the system mapped. There will always be things we don't know about systems, and that's why we need to think about them as being a little bit magical. I believe some of you actually saw Stuart Brand talk probably 10, 12, 13 years ago here at the IA Summit. Stuart Brand has this concept he's called pace layers, for those of you who haven't seen this before, which a number of individuals have talked about over the years, including Stuart himself. Pace layers are a way of thinking about the speed or pace of how things change over time. Fashion and art move incredibly fast, commerce is slower, infrastructure and governance even more slowly still, and culture is the slowest human creative effect to change. Or at least that's what the model is suggesting. Nature, well, that changes at a glacial pace, pun intended. There's two things here I want to point out which I find really interesting, and I hope you do too. The first is the notion that nature or environment changes more slowly than culture. There's a pretty fierce argument about climate change going on right now where people are essentially debating that nature can be changed faster than culture. I find that kind of interesting. The second thing I want to point out is actually an idea. I'd like to propose that making things, or specifically the intentional making of things, or design, is the most effective way to hack pace layers. Things we make that create behavior, the stuff we design, allows us to short-circuit the pace layer model. Just like the NAMSHUB in Neal Stephenson's book Snow Crash, design things can rewrite code and culture in a literal instant. designers, we have the tools to help us rewrite culture and environments too. And as I've suggested, this is a lot of power and a lot of responsibility. So if design is possibly a cultural hack and maybe the ultimate evolutionary hack, then what's actually happening here? There's many ways that people describe what design is and what design does. This is the current Wikipedia definition, which is pretty decent. It certainly falls into a place where the language and activities feel comfortable to most of us, things like planning, architecting, making. Today, I'm not interested in discussing how design gets done, although you're welcome to debate that amongst yourselves at the break. What I do want to do is talk a little bit more about what design does, and that's to drive behavior change at the level of individual actors and culture change at scale. Does anyone know what this is? Cool. I like you. So let me propose this. If the value of design is to influence or invent culture by creating an encounter between artifacts and entities, then something like graphic design creates culture with symbols, and industrial design creates culture with objects, and the emerging design practice we're interested in creates culture with systems. And I believe that in a networked world, software and systems are starting to become the same thing. Systems are made up of other systems, and an increasing number of these systems are shaped with the programs and rule sets that we're designing. I'll go a step further and suggest that our environment has become software, or maybe more appropriately, it was always software. We've just started adding our own software to it. Maybe Mark Andreessen was right. Software is eating the world, or in terminology that I prefer, subsuming it. It's certainly becoming a significant influence on our culture. As a side note, for those of you who are asking, where is the information in all of this? Only the most incomplete software doesn't have built-in information primitives. And the work that Stephen Wolfram has been doing over the last 30 years is a fascinating rabbit hole we can dive into some other time. I'm going to step back from the discussion of design and systems for a couple of minutes and talk about some more specific things, like what the design of software does for actors in the system and actors like us. Software is augmentation, like any other kind of tool, and it helps us do things. It's a very sophisticated type of augmentation, and we're honestly still wrapping our heads around what the point of software is. I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here and challenge that our community is at risk of missing the boat when it comes to software. We're out of touch, and we seem to have missed the point. It's not enough to care about what it is. We need to be obsessed about what it does. Our responsibility is not just to make software more usable. Making things easy to find isn't good enough either. I don't even think that it's about making things easy to understand. This stuff is the gravy. We need to focus on the meat. The point is augmentation. The point is making us more capable, or more appropriately, creating more capability. Again, the purpose of software is to give us superpowers. Of course, having a superpower that's easy to use is nice, but if you remove the need to learn a superpower, you limit an individual's exploration of that superpower. They're going to use it based on how you prescribed it, and they're less likely to get creative with it and use it in new and interesting ways in the environment. Software gives you superpowers. When we're working in our design practice at Normative, we're acutely aware of that at one level. Our job as designers is to augment people in ways that are quite frankly magical. Something like the Google search box is magical. It's like super memory. You can remember things you never even knew to begin with. The most successful software gives us incredible capability. This is an early conceptual prototype of an augmented reality application we've been working on for about a year. It's probably the most technically complex thing that we've ever worked on. Imagine if you took all of the computer vision and information analysis capability from spy satellites and drones and packed it into a mobile phone. What would you do with that? What we realized over endless numbers of iterations is that what we're dealing with here is not something like the precise positioning of geospatial imagery. What we're doing is we're giving people the ability to travel through time, time travel. That's the superpower that we're giving people with something like this. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that giving people superpowers isn't without risk or challenge. Power can be abused and used for everything from creating grief to enabling tyranny. The ethics of modeling is something we're going to need to spend a lot more time on and talk about more in the near future. I want to chat a little bit about containers and computation. The idea here is that increasingly, software exists in containers. I love this sketch that Dave Gray made recently to bring this quote by Mike Kuniowski to life. It's fantastic on so many levels. What's really exciting, and this does a really good job of expressing it, is that the stuff that software can be held in, the containers of software, as you will, are exploding in terms of scope and variety. Software containers can include physical objects like a wearable device, virtual objects like a web browser, organizational objects like a business, or cognitive objects like brains, feedback loops, systems, things like that. This computational power that's emerging on top of the internet is simply amazing. This network context includes a lot of things, many of which aren't human, but have agency, or what I'll call proto-agency. These information entities come in a myriad of forms: bots, APIs, algorithms, smart objects. You just can't keep track of them. I think we could even build an argument that hyperlinks have agency, but I'll need a beer or three before talking to the rest of you about that. All these objects and entities that we're talking about live and interact on the network we call the internet. It's more than just the web now. This is an emerging environment in which this broader swath of interconnected stuff can live, grow, and evolve, and we're part of it. The superpowers aren't just for us anymore. So at Normative, we design software systems that live on the network, sometimes as programmed agents, sometimes as interfaces for actors like people, and increasingly as systems themselves that are augmenting both human and non-human capability. We're designing for the network. And you should all follow Matt Nishlapidus because he has a completely different version of this talk, which is also very interesting. When we meet new clients, one of the first things we end up talking about is how the design challenges they're facing are much bigger than just creating a great user experience. The question I'd like to ask is, what can you do when you have the computational power of a million browsers and a million people pointed at your network infrastructure? What capability can you create for those actors, and what capability can you create for your organization? Our job as designers is to help our clients answer these questions. What problem are we solving, and how do we solve it? We have all this amazing connectivity and the ability to connect so many actors and create so much agency, but we sometimes struggle with what software we should create. We've become really good at making better shopping carts, but is this really the extent of our ability to improve the agency of actors in the systems we design? I don't think so. We need to become capable of more. We explicitly created Normative as a tool more than a business, a tool to design, to generate, and test hypotheses about the future of design. And our focus right now is on understanding what are we designing for. Our answer appears to be the network, but in all honesty, we're still unpacking this and expect to be for some time. While I don't have all the answers, I will share with you our directions or signals, and in particular, three signals, themes or theses that are becoming increasingly strong and influential in how we think about design for the world, and we think you should too. The first is this idea of a new aesthetic. Design for the network is more than just an activity, a perspective, or a mindset. The idea is that if we're going to design for this world, we also need a new aesthetic, a network aesthetic. Network aesthetic means that things that happen in and to networks have their own beauty. We're just starting to grasp what this looks like, judging how beautiful or compelling something is by its topology, its connectivity, its spikiness, its agency. Part of designing for the network is about pursuing this aesthetic. We've started using new language that's helping us put our arms around essentially what's a dark matter problem. And for those of you who don't get that reference, I'm going to stop for 30 seconds and let you all make a note of this book. This book is about $3 on Kindle. If you haven't read it and you're interested in the impact of your design practice, whether you see yourself as an information architect, interaction designer, or something else, if you're interested in how design really understands systems, you need to read this book. And at 150 pages, there's no reason you shouldn't read it. You got it? Okay. Let's get back to that new language for a second. These are some of the words, and not all the words, that we've been exploring to try and describe network aesthetic. Things like agency, texture, opacity, and reflexivity. We've been talking about agency a little bit. Agency is, quite simply, the capacity to act. And we're using this in the context of both humans and non-human actors. Can we understand the capacity to act? Whether it's an API, whether it's a user, doesn't really matter. Can we understand the agency? When I'm talking about texture, I'm describing the connectivity of interfaces, and not just screens, everything from APIs to physical things. What's the texture of that interface? Is it smooth? Is it rough? These are things that we need to start to explore in terms of talking about this stuff. Opacity is something that we use to describe the clarity of connections. How clear or comprehensive is the model that the interface is exposing to us, whether it's a data model, whether it's a conceptual model? The opacity of the network, the opacity of the system is important. And reflexivity helps us talk about the quality and richness of cause and effect loops. Essentially, can we tell what the feedback is like? And do we want to understand how to design the way in which feedback happens? That's reflexivity. This language isn't complete or carved in stone by any means, but we strongly believe that new language helps regenerate everything from organizations and practices to communities and cultures. The second thing I want to explore is the idea of learning and planning. And obviously here I think that learning is better than planning. If we get back to that comment I made about dark matter for a second, there's something you have to accept when you're dealing with complex systems. Regardless of what you believe, you're never going to fully understand a complex system. And assuming that you can begin to develop a model of a system without ongoing feedback and learning is just plain crazy. This is Peter Checkland, who I'm a big fan of. We've been heavily influenced at Normative in our design practice by a specific systems inquiry practice, which developed over the last 40 years by this gentleman, Peter Checkland, and a colleague of his, Brian Wilson, not the Beach Boy, obviously. And what this is, this practice, soft systems methodology, it's based on the idea that you can use conceptual models to inquire about the nature of a system, and that the feedback that you get from the real world is going to give you a slightly better understanding of the system. It's kind of like, imagine if you're in a dark room, you turn on the lights for a second, you get a snapshot of what's happening. But you can't make the assumption that the next time you turn on the lights, you're going to get the same snapshot, or that you're even going to be able to see everything in that split second. So you use conceptual models to inquire about the nature of the system, or a system, and that feedback gives you a slightly better understanding of the system. And you can turn this into a feedback loop that becomes an ongoing process, something that continually inquires into the nature of the system, helping you improve your models. This tool has been used for all kinds of things, including a very successful redesign of the British National Health Service in the 1970s. The feedback cycles that it's usually exposed to are fairly slow, but what excites us is the idea of using this model, this approach, as software. Essentially, every time you design software, you have the opportunity to use it to help you engage in the modeling process. We already do this in very rudimentary ways with things like analytics and tracking on websites and mobile devices, but I get excited about the idea of pointing software at a network system, not to surveil it, but to learn about it and from it so we can understand it better. Design for the network is really about this. Every piece of software we create needs to help us with this inquiry about understanding the system, the real world. Planning is good, but learning is better, and maybe we need to come up with a new word. Finally, I'd like to return to the point of software. It's to give people superpowers, right? Actually, I think it's pretty important that we consider that it needs to be more than just that. Some of you may have seen or own a little printer. How many people have a little printer? Yeah, I knew there'd be some people here who have a little printer. It's a fun little toy. I think it's also a genius design direction by the folks at Berg to get us comfortable with interacting with non-human things as if they are humans, conditioning us to deal with a wider range of actors, each with their own superpowers, even if in this case the superpower is only to print out your four square check-ins. The challenge is that environments and systems do best when they serve all actors to maintain a state of equilibrium. Systems tend to go crazy and go in unpredictable places when they're rigged to prioritize one actor at the expense of others. As designers, we need to start thinking about the whole system, not just people. We need to move beyond design as a purely anthropocentric practice. I think we need a new target for design, and people aren't it. This emerging design practice we're talking about, it might be the first design practice that isn't purely human-centered. We can't just design for one class of actors when we really do need to design for the network. I believe that the network and all the actors in it, including us, but more than just us, is what we need to design for. Yes, we want software to give us superpowers, to give us capability, but we can't just keep it to ourselves. We need to distribute it to the network. That's what we really need to focus on augmenting. So software gives everything superpowers, especially networks. That's a lot to absorb, and I appreciate you letting me share this thinking with you as we're exploring and learning. I'll be happy to take questions now.
Are you suggesting that by designing for the network, that we're designing for technical networks?
Absolutely.
Okay, so by doing that, are you suggesting, what's the thing in the Terminator?
Skynet.
I mean, are you basically like leading us to create Skynet?
No, but I do believe that if we aren't conscious and thoughtful about this, that's one of a million different outcomes. And if we are not conscious and thoughtful about what we're really designing for, we can end up with unintended consequences. Yeah. I'm not suggesting that our job is to design Skynet, although that's a fun thought experiment. Hey.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Fascinating. To follow on with that, though, I guess, can you dig a little bit into to what end?
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about where that goes. If it's not anthropocentric.
Centric, yes.
Thank you for doing that. Where does it lead? What's it for?
Sure. So an analogy that I like to use, but kept out of this because I didn't want to introduce too much stuff, but I'm going to now, is the parallels between digital environments and physical environments. I'm a big proponent of studying the past in order to understand the future. And one of the things that's really interesting is if you look at the history of the ecology or the ecological movement over the last 100 years, which essentially went from the idea of management to stewardship to sustainability. And as part of the transition to sustainability, one of the mindsets that evolved and emerged was this notion of deep ecology, which is related to the idea that in a system, in a complex ecological system like the Earth, we, as humans, should not make the assumption that just because we are conscious that we are better or more important actors than any other elements in the system, and just because we are conscious of our agency does not make our agency necessarily better. And so what I'm suggesting here is that there is a danger for us to go down a path of assuming that we are always the most important actors in an information system, in an information ecosystem. Doesn't mean that we should be marginalized. It means that we need to understand how we support states of equilibrium. Does that make sense? Andrew?
Sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. I grabbed the mic. Sorry, Simon. I got the mic.
Haha.
So, a couple thoughts or questions, I guess. We've talked about some of this before. One of the things that's really getting to me in terms of, I've been coming at this from another angle, but one of the things that's been getting to me is in order to get better at what we do, we have to start letting go of some reified notions of how we think reality works.
Yes.
And one of those notions is that we are individual people in a skin bag that is somehow separate and has separate agency and separate existence from all the stuff around us. So this all sounds very philosophical and weird, I realize. Frankly, I was like kind of struggling. Okay, Matthew, where are you going? Partly too, because I was having a hard time hearing. But now it's really clicking for me. And I guess I'm wondering things like, so for example, when we talk about user experience design, would you agree that there's an implicit thing there about what reality is,
yes.
about the centrality of a person who's
yes.
having an experience, and
yes.
it's all about making the environment be awesome for that experience, for that
yep.
user,
yep.
as if they're in the middle of a universe that revolves around them, right?
Yes.
And so we've been running into this, I think as a community we've been maturing some, but I guess talk a little bit about, like, in practical terms, when you talk with a business or client, how does this affect? Because I know that in our case, we've had to really start realizing we have to pay attention to the business's needs, because in a sense, they're an organ of the network, right?
Yes, totally.
And if we just did what users wanted, it would just eat the business alive. So, mm-hmm. and then it wouldn't be a service there anymore, right? How do you converse about this with, it was hard enough to get businesses to understand that users were important, but now it's like, well, it's complicated. So I don't know if that's a question yet, but run with
it. How do I honestly do that with businesses? We've thought about this a lot in terms of how we get to the point where we can have an explicit conversation so people can understand what we're doing. When we go in and work with a business, even if it is the most simplistic piece of software design, our mindset is this from the start. And we understand that you don't necessarily have to talk about your intention to make the value of your intention, the outcomes that come from that, valuable to your partners as well. And so what we do is we basically go in and we design software, and we don't leave the user-centered principles out. We don't remove them. We just consider a lot more, and we've built our team to be able to do that. So our team has shifted over the last couple years, as some of you know, from being all designers to people who are technologists, engineers, et cetera, et cetera. We're all working in a design-based way, and we're very focused on, quite frankly, understanding that the software that we build is the tools for inquiry, and the tools for inquiry that give us feedback into how users use it, but also, more importantly, what it means to businesses. So when we put a piece of software in front of people, that's our point of inquiry into their system. And one of the things that happens quite quickly is people ask, why did you do this? Why did you do this? And at that point, I kind of take somebody aside and put my arm around their shoulder and I say, do you want to have the red pill or blue pill conversation? And some of them want to have it, and some of them, quite frankly, don't. And our business does well because we do quality work. But for the individuals who are interested in hearing about the broader perspective, that's when we have the million browsers conversation. Because what we really want them to understand is, what are the opportunities around value exchange that we can create in a networked environment with software. Some of those are going to be great for people, some of those are going to be great for the organization, and other things like that. And a lot of them we don't even really understand. But this is one of the ways we become comfortable with businesses, because as designers we're often not. But when you start to look at a business as a subsystem in a larger system, and you're trying to do a lot of different things with that, and when you start to empathize with the business and understand that, you start to stop raging against it and start trying to look at, how can I understand it better? And we talk a lot, and this is a bit of a digression, we talk a lot at work about, how can we empathize with an API? What does that mean? How can we understand that? We know the language isn't right, but what's that relationship? How can we really feel for what that needs in the system? I don't know if that answers your question or not, but.
I love this idea of the network aesthetic. I'm definitely going to have to pick your brains more about that.
Sure.
I suppose there is a paradox in what you say, though, because, or I want to hear you talk more about how anthropologically we can divide ourselves or be separated from the things that we create and we use.
Impossible.
Exactly.
Impossible. Go ahead. Sure. Just want to maybe restate that a little bit louder for.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of hear more about this idea of how you can anthropologically be separated from the things that we use, and
right,
because that's quite interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, these things are products of our brain. We use them. What is their function? I suppose what I'm really getting at is that systems are important, and we talk about software,
mm-hmm.
but really, I think that's a bit of a red herring. I think what's more important is the information that flows between them, and more importantly, how we use that information as human beings.
Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you, we saw that as a challenge from the beginning, just as, for example, as a man, I will never truly appreciate feminist theory, right? I'm always going to be a man, but that doesn't mean that I can't work on understanding it and incorporating my perspective of that into what I do, and at least being aware of my bias. And one of the things that I think we need to do here is just at the very least address our bias towards our prioritization of people over like non-human actors in systems. I think at the very least, it's a blind spot for us as designers. At the very least, awareness of your biases and prejudices is a good first step, and that's kind of where we're at. I don't have a good answer for you on how you actually really deeply understand that, because we've only been thinking about this for 5 years.
But Checklin does. He refers Certainly. To a model or a framework called CATWO.
Yes, he does.
Which would be a great process for UX. And I've been studying about how to create a UX discovery that incorporates CATWO.
So the gentleman here who wants to ask me the next question, he and I did a talk specifically on that in Vegas.
Yeah, 2007.
And as I was saying to Peter right before this, it was the ugliest deck I've ever been part of. But I love you, Gene.
Well, was that just your part? I thought my part was
great. My part was brutal.
That was a fun presentation. There will be a little bit of CATWO in my talk tomorrow. I feel like you sort of left us at the cliff here, which is what this emerging design practice looks like.
Because it's not finished.
Yeah. Can you just share a few words about how that's manifesting itself in your studio and where you see that going?
Sure. So what it's meant, and actually, I don't know if folks were downstairs for the Spotify thing today. Yeah, you should have been in that, because our organizational structure looks increasingly like that type of organization, where we become very pod-based, very tight, small teams. Increasingly, those teams are reporting to or responsible for outcomes, and I have less and less concern personally around how they do it. We've adopted OKRs as our management model, which some of you may know, and Christine in the back is dancing. If you want to really incorporate OKRs in your organization, you should hire her. And she's writing a book, apparently. Yes? Yes. And the purpose of doing something like OKRs, which I'm not going to get into detail, but was quite frankly to do two things. One, help people focus on big goals and outcomes as opposed to how they did stuff. We wanted people to be flexible in how they did stuff. And we also wanted better situational awareness in the organization so that there was less prescription and direction and more problem solving. So we're actually, and we talk about this a lot, our business is becoming more and more like a network, which means that I have less and less control over it. Yeah. One more question?
I have a very quick question.
Yes, that is Surgeon Simulator up on my screen.
Do you think we're at the point culturally where users are comfortable seeing themselves as part of the network instead of this separate entity that just serves them?
You know, I'll come back to the superpowers thing for a bit. And I may be a contrarian here, but I don't really think so much about the comfort of it. I'm not saying I'm anti-great experience for the users. I actually think that when you need to make things easy and seamless and work well, it's really important. But I'm not so concerned about making everybody comfortable, because that type of negotiation rarely moves anything anywhere, right? And so I think one of the challenges and great things about being a designer is that we do get to be arrogant and normative and suggest that things should go a certain way, but we also have to have the humility to learn from our mistakes. And, you know, sometimes at Normative, we'll err on the side of not prioritizing certain aspects of the user experience in order to get a better software experience across the board. It's something we're still figuring out, but I certainly wouldn't prioritize the comfort of users. If we focused on making everybody comfortable all the time, it'd be a pretty awful place. Thanks, folks. I really appreciate it.
The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thank you for listening.